So this is part two of our interview. If you missed the first half, feel free to go back and have a listen.
So let's just hover on verbal assault a little bit, and then I want to kind of sure. head towards the like another part of your life. Verbal assault. I'm going to say this. You're not saying it. You could agree or disagree. One of the rare bands that gets better over time than worse. Like wow. One of the bands from record to record to record as they evolve becomes more and more interesting and like more and more vibrant rather yep. than, you know, demo bands that kind of like they're awesome at first and they start sucking.
Yeah. Opposite for us. Yeah. We played out so much. So early, so young, like we were, yeah, as soon as I got that van, my dad, coolest thing he did was got a van from like a police auction that some, I think it was some like drug addicts had like broken into, and we had to start it for the first 2 months with a screwdriver. And I remember like cleaning it out meticulously because I was like, oh, there's like heroin smoke in here or something. But he got us this van, you know, made like a loan schedule, so we had to pay it back, which is ultimately really cool. Like, you know, it was a cool move, I think, to train your kid to stuff costs money, and you know. But so, like, I became the responsible dude in the van that would like track the money and make sure we paid the van payment, and you know, kept that running.
Well, verbal assault again. This is me saying it, not you saying it. It's like your band got. Your band was always good, not a bad record, but like consistently got better. But also, again, I'm interested in your thoughts. You guys seem to take your band a little bit more seriously than most.
Yeah, it's. I mean, we left on our first national tour the morning after high school graduation.
Right, dude, that's which, crazy.
It's not that punk that we graduated, but it's punk that we left the next fucking morning. And I was like building the loft, you know, late that night. So like that's how ready we were, like the day after we were gone. And then we just fucking toured so much and we played out so much before that. And it was a cool, really inspiring time to be on the East Coast and to be up and down the Eastern Seaboard at all these shows and, you know, to see Bad Brains in kind of their prime. You know, it was like Bad Brains were Grateful Dead to me. You know, anywhere they'd play, I'd go, you know, within 8 hours. It was just fucking exciting. And we were so young and it's all we cared about. And I think I was just funny enough to trick my way into the hearts of all these like important people. Basically everyone except Al couldn't crack Al. He was just too big and tough and muscly and mean from afar. I just couldn't use my charms to get through that guy. But, you know, like Ian and Kevin are basically my like cool uncles. And, you know, I mean, Ian recorded my first record and then basically put me on the path of what I do today, which is pretty bizarre. And, you know, Kevin gave us Kevin talked Ian into recording the record. He wasn't going to do that. Bunch of Rhode Island little nerds. Our singer would like have like little pencil cases and like organized tour briefcases with like, you know, song set list writing Sharpies and like, yeah, just wasn't, yeah. Without Kevin, Ian would never have done that and who knows where I'd be. But yeah, so we were so serious about it. You know, Chris was really good about passing out like Amnesty International or Greenpeace literature at shows, and he was really driven. His dad was a newspaper reporter, and I think he had that sort of it was just in the DNA, you know, to spread information and yeah, I think we got good because we fucking played so much because we got that van when I was like 16 years old in one day, and we were just very driven. So by the time we got to Trial, which let's be honest, that's the record everyone thinks about when they think about Verbal Assault, we were so just ready and knew what we wanted to sound like. And I was egomaniacal enough to make the engineer do it He was like, there's no fucking way you want the guitars this loud. And I was like, nah, I do. And Chris would back me up. And so, yeah, it was just young, single-minded people just kind of thriving in this really cool community.
I got three things, two comments and a question. Comment one, Trial is a record that you can listen to in any state, in any mood. You could be super excited and you can listen to Trial. You could be super concentrated and listen to Trial. Or you could be super like kind of like bummed and like down and you can listen to Trial. It's like a real, it's a real every mood record, which is cool as hell.
Yeah.
Second,
thanks.
I'm going to go on record as saying you have the best guitar tone out of anyone in hardcore.
Oh, that. Just the little thing I threw together.
Dude, unreal. Oh. Right. So here's my question. Why Giant Records? Like what is that? How did that happen?
At the time, let's see, how'd it go? You know, our first record, Positive Force, Kevin, and Positive Force just, it kind of, you know, just sort of fizzled out. And so our first record was quickly unavailable. And we were like, fuck, that sucked. You know, and we couldn't even get copies for a while. And no shade to Positive Force, they tried. But, that, you know, they had like, I think they had kind of an unscrupulous manufacturer and just that whole 80s, you know, just kind of, we had the feeling of, you know, a record that becomes unavailable quickly. And Giant came out and it was Steve Ricardo, really cool dude, had a very clear vision. It was shockingly us, Dag Nasty, Uniform Choice, even a little later, and Government Issue, and then some other bands later. But he, you know, he kind of put his eye on these, you know, that, like, that's a coherent lineup. And, you know, he pretty much had me at Government Issue. And then with Dag Nasty, it was like, fuck, this could be a really cool thing. It wasn't as indie and punk as a lot of stuff, but it felt like, you know, could be a very smart move. They had good distribution because of Dutch East India. And, it felt like a potential smart fit rather than, I mean, we didn't actually have any, there wasn't anyone else. Hey, we want to put your record out at the time that I can remember. So it seemed like the best option. And we had like a lot of those songs we'd had for a long time and we're like, didn't have a label that, can't think of a single label that was in play at the time. And so, yeah, we did it. We signed the thing. They gave us $5,000 to record, which at the time was insane. And we spent all of it. And then somehow that fucking label fizzled out too. And Trial became unavailable really quickly again. And we still, this day, the exact rights of that album are still a little dubious. So that happened to us again. And should have listened to Ian MacKay and not done that. I don't think he told us not to do it. But, you know, in spirit, he did. He listed all the pitfalls of going that route. So yeah, Verbal, that's, I mean, now as Verbal Assault started playing shows again a couple of years ago, and, you know, it's pretty obvious that not having your records available out in the world for 30 years, not good for the band, you know, it kind of shows that if we had available records for the last 30 years, probably be a hotter, hotter night out than it is. And I'm very happy with my old band, but it's a bummer that our records kind of befell that fate.
I saw you guys in New York. Monica and I flew out to catch the second show, and it was like phenomenal. Oh,
totally. You were there.
Well, I didn't know you at the time. I was not right up front, and it was great because it was like a class reunion for a lot of my buddies from all over the West Coast were out to see it. It was really cool, really special. Yeah, it was great. Actually, I was supposed to, anyways, long story short, I want to hit a next chapter, but, let me tell you, my favorite verbal assault record is on. It is, oh my God, dude, that record, I could go on, but it is phenomenal. Yep. But even up to and including Exit, like, just interesting, cool band, went on, explored a lot of stuff. Then you moved over to DC to go into college. And I want to kind of bring it back full circle here. And we talked about business, and I kind of use that term, and please, anyone associated with Discord, forgive me. I don't mean it in a negative way, but like the discording of like, how do we charge for things as punks?
Yep.
Like, there's no... One of the things I talk a lot about on the podcast is those guys just kind of being like, oh, well, how do you make a record cover? And then just taking apart covers, making a template, cutting, like screening it, cutting it out and assembling it.
Yep.
And how, if you tell the story now, it doesn't sound like that big a deal. But that idea that back then there was a whole industry, and that whole industry just seemed like, well, that's the record industry. And if you want to play in this, you got to go there. And they're like, no, why don't we just figure out how to do it ourselves? Mm-hmm. And I know that they're not the only people, you know, all that, but they're the people we're talking about now. That idea of taking apart a record cover and figuring out how to screen it and do it and get your records pressed and charge whatever you want to charge.
Yeah.
That to me is the template of almost any kind of business. Like, any business out there, you could essentially take apart the record cover of and figure out how to do your own version of it. Any thoughts on that before I go further?
Just the phrase backwards engineering is something I use a lot in my life, where I do it a lot, you know, take shit apart to figure it out. And that aspect of the early days, simple little thing, but I can tell you've identified it kind of like I have, as like it's like the first crow with a stick or so, or the first, it is big. It's very fucking big to figure out the tabs, and like, and Jeff was smart enough, I think, to figure out all the registration points, which I still don't know much about that, but it is like a DNA kind of moment to me, where like that is the seed fucking sprouted into the whole thing. It's usually a couple smart or sometimes just lucky dudes, but to have like Mackay and fucking Jeff Nelson, like, get the brain trust that just started the most organized, like, coherent, curated label, just a blessing on our fucking whole lives. To, you know, it just warms my heart that that's kind of what spawned it.
Totally. And going back to the beginning of our conversation, it's like kind of a template of how to do business, but like, do business and not be an asshole and like, be smart about it. Cause very, like, what they did was like, I know they were kids, so I'm like, I don't want to like try and rewrite the story to fit my narrative, but seeming now many years later seems very smart what they did, like quite like thought out to a degree. And I use a term like when I'm, so the way I started my business, I worked for another company, and I was kind of like tricked into working for this other company. It's this long story. I won't go into it. I was working for this other company, and it was ran by a total asshole and like a total rich kid who had never worked in a normal job anywhere. It grew up in their parents' company.
Rich kids.
Well, listen, I think you can grow up with money. That's one thing. And then I think you can be a rich kid. And it was ran by just this rich kid, total asshole. And the way he would talk about things was, if anyone was ever like, hey, you know, like, maybe we could do it like this or do it like that, it was like, like, you're an idiot. You don't get it. You don't get it. And the whole time I was in that company, I was just observing this guy who I just deeply just disliked. But I was also like learning a lot from him, like learning a lot from being in the industry, and actually learning quite a bit from him. And I kept thinking, this is like a record cover that I got to disassemble. And it's a term I use. It's like disassemble, like, or break down the record cover. Cause it's like, okay, there's clearly a way to do this way, way, way better. Mm-hmm. And also to not be a dick about it and actually create like a way, way better services, better impact, da, da, da. when I started my company, it was all literally just pulling apart a record cover and figuring it out. Now, the way I'm talking about it sounds calm, but it was like years of studying something, paying attention to something. And then the moment where I was like, I'm starting my own thing was like kind of a panic moment of like, oh shit, now I'm on my own. But the way I've built up the company has been consistently about that. And it really does start with the idea of like, there's no forever thing. Everything can be deconstructed. Like you said, like reverse engineer it, figure out how to do it and then rebuild it better. But around that is like the pricing piece. And actually, before we get to the pricing piece, I want to hit on the like, you know, when you say Ian kind of set you on this path. First of all, before we say anything, how crazy is it that you redid the basement of the Discord house where Minor Threat used to practice? Is that nuts?
It was the first floor, but...
Oh, the first floor.
Yeah. Yeah. I keep meaning to put on my website a little section of just every Ian interview, because he always sits in the same chair with the same mug in front of the window. You know, like I stripped all the lead paint off his windows. And so all the wood windows behind him, I just wanted to put like 30 different pictures of interviews of my work instead of the houses. Just have a full Ian in front of my stripped windows. This is comically weird. I just looked up some Mackay art that stares at me every day. It's me and Ian playing ping pong. He fucking crafted this. Speaking of crafting, made a little cardboard thing and glued on photos and did letterpress.
That's sweet, man. That's really nice.
This is table tennis. And to this day, I'm still a fucking vicious ping pong player.
Good for you. All right. So it must have been crazy for you just being like this. Like, I know that you guys were friends and, you know, you saw Minor Threat and all that, but that's an insane piece of history to be involved in, just to even have done work on that house.
It's pretty cool. Yeah. I do often wonder, like, would I be a fucking carpenter right now if it wasn't for that? I honestly don't know.
Well, and where I wanted to go with that was, you'd been around, like you kind of learned the DIY stuff from punk and hardcore, and also like some of the activism stuff from like early life with your mom. And then some of the like the financial stuff from your dad buying the van and teaching you that financial responsibility. You've been on tour, you've done all these things. But then you're going and you've got this friend who gives you a shot. He's like, hey, can you finish this piece of work? It sounds like in your story, mentorship played like a pretty big role, because even when you moved out to Olympia, you had this person who took you under your wing. 7 Seconds took you under the wing. The guy from Vicious Circle took you under the wing. So what are your thoughts about mentorship?
I think about it a lot, because builders, I think, are usually kind of like secretive and, you know, competitive, and not exactly like that by nature. But I've had so many glaring examples of just people extending, you know, knowledge and just kindness and direction to me, that I have, especially with this passive house thing, which is like an atypical thing. So I've built some of the earlier ones in towns, and there's a bunch of young guys doing it. Some, you know, a lot of guys have worked for me, and I've tried to be kind of extra generous with the info. You know, try to stay in the very cooperative lane. And I don't know that I've been anyone's exact mentor yet, but I've been helpful as hell, I think. And them, you know, being like a direct one-on-one mentor, I won't claim that I am one, but I, you know, with like all my carpenters, I just try to be the most positive, helpful, you know, any knowledge, fair game. Like when I was flirting with the, you know, who are now my partners, you know, and we're in that kind of year and a half phase, you know, my pitch was like, I'll teach you everything I know and, you know, share all my great ideas with you, and take them or leave them, you know, if you want to sign up at the end of that, do it. If not, you know, no worries. I'm happy to share. Long story short, I think it's just that I've tried to, you know, continue. it all goes back to punk, but it's, you know, not be a dick and be helpful rather than, you know, just hold on to the little advantage you might have. Like, fuck that, you know, and that's the beauty of the passive house component of what we do. It's like, I want everyone to do this to, you know, to help with climate change and stop all our friends from getting sick from mold and toxic materials and all that. So it's really sweet to have the craft combined with those more important things I strive for.
Around like pricing and all that, you know, so you had that mentor who'd been like, dude, what are you doing? Like, you're building these really cool things, you're not charging enough.
Yeah.
And this is something Jason Farrell said in his podcast, is like, a lot of punks struggle a bit with that, like, is making money bad and going back totally. To, you know, all the old Discord stuff. It's like, when you look at the price of those records, and of course, how much things cost now is so much more different. But even like when I was younger and I was touring, there was this, like, the first band that I ever heard charge $5 for 7 inches. People were like, oh, they're charging $5. Can you believe it? It's like, dude, it is beyond time to charge. You should be charging way more than that.
You're out of the scene.
Yeah, totally, man. So like, how have you dealt with that? Like that kind of like tension that people have around like making money or charging their value or any of that?
I'll just say it. Like, I was in DC for bulk of the Fugazi years, maybe not the last few, but like I got to the point where like I was in my head, I was kind of banging like, dude, charge $7, you know, like, you know, like come on, like, but you know, they were so fucking popular and like. You know, in my just practical head, I was like, you know, inflation, you know, just scale size, like, you know, you could start a small retirement for yourself, you know, that like the $5 thing went on for so long that I got to the point where I was like, I don't think this is practical. I don't think I support it. I'm going to pay to see fucking Fugazi. I'd pay 30, but,
oh, dude.
So I personally got to a thing where I was like, I would usually talk to Ian about, like, I was really good about blurting these things out. I can't remember if we ever talked about it, but if we didn't, what I would have said was like, yeah, how about $6? Maybe they finally went to $6. Did they? I don't know. But I got to a point where for several years, I was like, I felt like Ian was making too much of a point. And that he was like superseding just basic practicality, where like $7 might, you know, pay your band members a little more. So I don't fucking know, but I got to the point where I was like, this is crazy. You're just, you know, you're underselling yourselves. And it's not like I want them to be rich, but you know, $5 was practical in 88, by 94. Everything's more expensive. You know how the world works. That's a long-winded way of saying maybe I got over, you know, getting stuck on a number. And, you know, maybe that was a help in my business career, just to like, you know, charge what felt right and practical and just to me for things, you know, later in my life when I became a business person. I did have a frustration of a good friend that I thought was just making a point for too long. You just raised the dollar amount. God damn it.
My team, my company actually had to have an intervention with me. We were doing like a retreat and they sat me down and were like, we need to charge more. And I was like, no, you know, this is blah, blah, blah. And they're like, no, we have to. And it was just like, really, like, I actually got like super upset. Like, kind of got like,
yeah,
like, it was like a thing I had to get over. And I also had a client who refused. They were like the Pete in the scenario where they're like, I'm not paying you that little. Like, this is what mid-market would be. So if you're not like a super high one and you're not a super low one, this is where you're going to be. And that's what I'm going to pay you. So I had like kind of interventions on both. And it's funny, like years later, looking back on it, it's like, there's so much like so much honesty and integrity with like really trying to like make sure your pricing is fair. And also it's like, and from a place of just like longevity, being able to do things the right way, pay people fairly, give people benefits, you do have to have other factors in. But it's tough. Like if you grow up in that DIY culture and the punk scene, it's a hill that a lot of people have to climb to get there in the right way.
I totally agree. I kind of got some scolding from my partner just this morning because I was going to start with this, but like literally today was kind of a kick in the, like a punch in the gut day. Just I think the whole tariff thing just sank the next job that I was pretty positive was a sure thing. So just this morning, just got the vibe like, oh, this fucking very important job in severe doubt. And looking at my 13 dudes and I'm like, fuck, like I might have to call and consult you later. How the hell to do this kind of thing. But it's not all like roses and fucking perfect. Like I, as of today, have a Trump-related big problem. And to tie that with the money component, you know, as part of this whole buildup with the company, you know, I just have lots of smart people. You know, we started a real 401k for the dudes about a year ago and real health benefits and did a smart analysis of what we really, really need to charge. But I still fight to stay on the overly competitive side because despite doing pretty sexy projects, I just don't want to be the guy that's just charging more just for the sake of it. But, you know, we're paying ourselves well, paying the dudes, you know, retirement, paid time off, like all the stuff I thought I always would do, but always found it hard when I literally wasn't charging enough. So,
yeah, man.
Yep. Combining, you get it. This is what you do. But the, you know, finally being at the spot where I'm actually paying for all the things that I assumed I would be feels good. It's also pretty damn expensive. So wrapping my brain around that, just this is literally just the last 3 years. And it turns out I'm still like cheaper than most builders in town that are building fucking shitty toxic mold boxes. So you can do it all.
All right. So I'm going to ask you a couple personal questions before we head into the end of the interview. I don't know if you remember, you did an interview for a book called All Ages like many, many years ago.
Yeah.
And so I was like, dude, whatever happened to Pete from Verbal Assault? You know, you did Rain. Well, right. You did Rain like the Sound of Trains. Mm-hmm. And then poof, you seemed to disappear. And it was a different time, right? Like the internet was like kind of a just becoming a thing. You know,
just,
there
wasn't
a ton of stuff online. And you were this dude that was like such a force in the scene. You'd done so many bands, or you'd done bands and they'd been really cool bands with lots of releases. You'd done a ton of touring. You'd been one of the bands who like really started opening up Europe for North American bands, which is like a whole other podcast we could do.
Yeah.
And then poof, you were gone. So what was up with that?
Rain Like the Sound of Trains was fucking awesome. But, you know, financially and, you know, popularity wise, not great. And I loved the band so much, I didn't care. And we toured for years, but we had all those, like, remember like the Maxim Rock and Roll, they wouldn't review our 7-inch. Do you remember that whole thing?
Cause it wasn't punk. It
wasn't punk enough.
So crazy.
And it was the same month that they did a Bad Religion, Noam Chomsky 7-inch. A Bad Religion, you know, they were like touring in buses at the time in Europe. And I was like, it's like, what is punk, Tim? And, you know, finally just called him and was like, what's up? He's like, yeah, it just doesn't sound punk to me. And I was like, all right, you know. And, you know, as you know, personally, I was like, I haven't actually read Maxim Rock and Roll in 4 years. So maybe this is just an honest divergence between two. And like, I knew Tim, like, or, you know, I've played Risk with Tim. We've stayed at his house. And we were tight. But he just hated that band. He said it. He said we sounded like Rush, which hurt me because I've always hated Rush.
Hey!
I'm sorry, man. I'm not gonna be one of those middle-aged guys that's like, I always loved Rush. No, like three dungeon masters gone fucking crazy with.
I'm seeing three different reactions. I got Mike pumping his fist in the air. I got
fuck Monica, Rush.
I got Monica smiling, like totally laughing and smiling.
Yeah.
How dare you? All right. Okay.
So we can deal with that in our third podcast, but, there's that. And then I mentioned this in a podcast recently. Never going to say this, but like Discord helps ran like the Sound of Trains, and Ian like lent us money to record the demo tape. Same with all the 7 inches, probably the record too. I think even, yeah, but we were never like a full Discord release. And I was always like, fuck. So I had like Tim and like Ian. They're like, you know, like totally supporting. But like Ian's like, nah, it's just, you know, it wasn't his thing. And then after several years of touring, I noticed it wasn't lots of people's thing. Just too many notes. It's like the Amadeus thing. And it just ran its course. We had an awesome, really fun European tour where we knew I was going to move to Olympia after it. And by then I was fucking just tired. My ears, like the tinnitus thing was insane. And I wanted to just do something kind of tangible. So that's why I went out to Olympia to study organic farming, which was right when that interview in the All Ages book was. So that book makes it seem like I like left for a career in organic farming. And it was like 3 weeks of shoveling manure. And I was like, fuck this. I'm never doing that. Like, I can't do this. I'll be terrible. That led to the construction thing. And I actually moved to Olympia. I shouldn't say that I was like retiring from music, because I've told the story on like 5 podcasts now. I'll do it really quick. 2 days before I left DC, ran like the Sound of Trains, recorded right next to the Black Cat. Sunny Day Real Estate played their last show at the Black Cat the last night we were recording. I knew those guys. Nate had actually jumped in the Verbal Assault van to one of our Vancouver shows in 1989. And hilariously at the border, I turned around and asked him and my friend Lenny if they had any like legal issues. And Nate was really quiet and shy at the time. He's like, oh yeah, I have a warrant for throwing a cinder block through a McDonald's window. And we're like, fuck, Nate. He's like the totally like shy, quiet kid. And so all you people that fucking make fun of the Foo Fighters just know that Nate was fucking keeping it real. So Sunny Day Real Estate played their last show. Me, Nate, and William hung out at a table on the Black Cat. And I was like, you know, it was their last show. They were kind of emo. I was leaving DC. I was kind of emo. And I was like, you know, I'm moving to Olympia tomorrow. And they were like, fuck, we should start a band. And I was like, we should start a band. And so for like an hour, we got all kind of stoked up. This is like a movie scene to me. Bartender comes over. It was a corded phone with a super long cord. He's like, to William, are you William? He's like, yeah. He's like, phone's for you. Weird. It's like 2 a.m. Long story short, it's Dave Grohl. William comes back to the table and he's like, that was Dave Grohl. He wants me and Nate to be in his new band. And I was like, motherfucker. Fucking serious. But William and I played together for like a couple years during that whole thing. And then during his whole like leaving of that band. And we have like 12 glorious unreleased songs just waiting for the right singer. So I wasn't like going to retire and be an organic farmer. Like I thought I had a band, at least for that hour. And then I don't know, construction, I'll be honest, construction. The more I did construction, the less I wanted to practice really loud music in basements after like using nail guns all day. And then the first kid showed up, and right around then I did a little tour with my friend Lois. We recorded with Brendan Canty a little bit. But then after that, the little baby crawling around, I thought that would be my time to like pick the guitar back up, but the first kid hated it when I would play guitar because I would drift away. So she would always like push the guitars over, and she was like, yeah. She didn't like my chops. And then I started building our first house. Then we had another kid building our second house. And then like the guitars just went away for like 2 decades. Seriously. It just became like a not something I did. I was just fucking tired and my ears ringing all the time. So it's taken a while to get back to.
All right, we're going to head into the crucial three. Three questions that increasingly are more difficult as we go up. But before we do anything, and we'll put all the links to your company and everything in the bio. Question number one, if you were to think of the most impactful person for you in your entire career, and career being whatever you want to, however you want to define it, who's the most impactful person and why?
It's Ian, come on. Just such a lovable but massive figure in my life. Think about him all the time. Think about funny shit he said all the time. I thought today, I was driving, got cut off, thought about him. I remember this time we were driving to a softball game where same thing happened. Someone kind of cut him off. And he was just like, have some fucking compassion to the other driver. Just always stuck with me. I'm like, that's what you yell at the guy? Like, have some fucking compassion. Yeah, it would have to be Ian, man. And not to overdo it, but yeah. How to think, how to act, how to work in this world, how to kind of create your own fucking environment, and how to just be true to what you really want in this life. It's got to be him. And then maybe a close second to Tibor Brewer, my carpentry mentor. He was a very similar...
Holy shit.
At a storm. Close second would be Tibor Brewer, my carpentry mentor.
All right. What's one thing in your, like, in building up your business? Now we're talking specifically about your business. What's one thing you learned about yourself through doing that you really like about yourself? Like something you've discovered about yourself that you're like, hell yeah, I feel good about that.
I've shocked myself with the kind of the capacity, like the big project capacity to pull all these long, complicated things off and remain great friends with all the people involved, including the clients usually. Like I kind of getting very used to it, but often can't believe I'm building these crazy projects from start to finish. I have a lot more help now, but especially in the old days, it was like, how the fuck did I do this? So I guess that's the part that kind of surprises me. And I guess makes me feel good about myself. I guess at this stage in my career, I guess I'm kind of an expert at it. Which feels bananas because throughout several days a week, I'm like, how the fuck do I do this? And just able to figure it out and pull it off. Big project energy, I guess, is my observation about myself that I kind of like. I've been able to pull off a lot of cool shit.
Yeah. All right. Final question. For anyone listening to this who's like, staring into the oblivion of possibly working a career that they just don't want to do, where they're like, I just don't want my life to be an endless series of working jobs that I hate, but kind of feels like scared to do something else. Any advice that you have for anyone who's kind of thinking like, how do I follow my passion? How do I find that for myself?
Using myself as the guinea pig, I'm so glad I acted on the instinct I had when I was just kind of exhausted from music to pursue like a tangible craft. Like I knew I was happier when I did things with my hands and, you know, did something skilled. I'm thrilled that I I listened to that. I was thinking farming, and that turned into carpentry. And I guess listen to that kind of deeper instinct. If you're like, if I went down the computer route, and I could have, like, I literally went to, I think, one of America's first computer camps in Moodus, Connecticut in like 1976.
Oh my God.
Like, my dad was like, "You're doing this." And I was like, "This," I hated it. I was like, "This sucks." And just played basketball the whole time. And to this day, I can't find a file on my fucking computer to save my life. So I would say, especially, I mean, you could do it at any part in your life. I mean, don't commit career suicide because of me, but I'm an example of someone that listened to it wasn't like a screaming, like, "You need to go do hard physical labor and fuck up your back and become bald and tired." But I knew there was something in me that knew, like, I was happiest, like, building, making, you know, and I had a little bit of an untapped itch. Like, I wanted to become good at some sort of craft-based, tangible thing. And computer stuff is totally tangible and legit. But I'm picturing lots of people sitting at their laptops like, "What the fuck am I doing?" And there is other shit out there. And, like, you know, I've in my industry, I've seen a bunch of a lot of my energy nerd friends have gone from energy nerds to full builders just because, like, they want to enact the, you know, that a lot of my friends do energy modeling, which is like predicting how the building will work. And I've seen a couple of them become incredible builders just to fulfill that goal. So there's other shit out there. Especially young people, fuck. Become an electrician. Jesus fucking Christ. You'll be rich. You'll be so needed. And the world is going to electrify despite all the fucking ups and downs. It just fucking has to. So there's like a bazillion careers out there in the electrical based field that no one is doing. I can't trick my daughters into it, I don't think, at this point, but maybe you can.
Dude, this has been awesome, man. Thank you so much. Anything you want to say as we sign off?
Oh, I just appreciate it. I've really enjoyed all the podcasts of yours that I've listened to. And I seriously do. I need an emergency session tonight because this fucking tariff thing might have just fucked my arm and I need some consulting or some therapy.
Drop me a text if you want to talk. We can talk.
I think that's what you do. I've still never been clear on what you actually do, but we can talk about that later.
Yeah. Yeah. Listen. And just as we're closing off, man, I just want to say, I'm in a very privileged position where I get to speak to people that I, you know, spent my life listening to their records and, like, kind of help me think bigger and think about the world. And you're one of those people. Verbal Assault is a really, really, really important band to me. And getting to see you in New York was such a trip. You know, Monica was laughing about it because I was on like cloud nine. So thanks for everything you did then. And also thanks for what you're doing now, man, because I think your business is super cool.
Appreciate it. Thanks, RM. Yep.
See you next time. Thanks,
everyone. Thanks, Mike. Thanks, Monica.
Bye-bye.